Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of hope and the podcast of solutions. I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today we are doing another, it's our second pre-budget special podcast. Today we are doing it on the issue of children, inequality, disadvantage, also women and gender, and looking at these issues from the perspective of different organizations who are doing incredible work in these areas and who are also working at the front line and putting forward solutions and policy proposals. And I'm joined today by Orla O'Connor, Director of the National Women's Council of Ireland, Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, and Louise Bayliss, who is co-founder of the Single Parents Acting for the Rights of Kids, Spark. We're going to talk, as I said, about inequality for particular groups in our society, and particularly want to talk around the issues of housing, work, poverty, and COVID as well, and how that's impacting. And firstly, we want to talk about the issues and kind of what is happening on the ground and how are people being affected and what are you as organizations seeing. So maybe, Orla, if I go to you first, could you kind of tell us, for the National Women's Council, what kind of are the big issues of inequality that you're seeing in Ireland today?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happened over COVID is that, I mean, there's been two things. It's exposed the inequalities that have been there for women, and in some areas, it's really increased them. So it's really put a light, for example, on the whole issue of care in our society and the fact that women are doing the majority of care work. And it's also really shown that, you know, particularly, I think, during the harder restrictions, though, you know, we're back to that to some extent, that it's very much relying on women to pick up the pieces in terms of care and to provide all those supports in families. And we just finished a survey on that area in the Women's Council, and it showed the impact on particular groups of women, particularly lone parents, on impacts to mental health of women because of that whole extra piece that they were doing and that they had been doing before, but as I said, it got increased. I mean, the other sort of big areas in terms of the impact at the moment are impacts particularly around violence against women and particularly domestic violence. So we saw during the sort of harder restrictions where people were very much in their homes with their abusers that their chances for being able to look for support were really limited. And that's like, I think one of the things that COVID and the pandemic has shown is that, you know, frontline services for domestic violence and for violence against women need to be seen as core public services in our society. They're not residual, and they need to be funded in that way. And I'll say a bit more about that. The other, I think, key parts, and this is global as well as in Ireland, is that, you know, very much frontline workers, you know, we're in areas where women predominated. So whether we're talking about in the care sectors, in the health sectors, and also what we're seeing is that the jobs that women did, because women, for much of women's work, it's in low paid work, that they're the jobs that have also been lost. And I think that's a really big issue as we're living with the pandemic, but in terms of where women in work and out of work are at the moment. The other just maybe final thing to say on it is that, you know, one of the things that we've seen during the crisis is there has been some positive responses by government. So, for example, coming in and paying the wages of childcare sector workers. We also saw it in terms of the welfare payments, because they were all individualised. They were paid to women individually. So they were significant changes. And I think, you know, they're really big issues now in terms of as we live with this crisis, but also as we come out of it, how can we keep some of those really positive responses? And I'm very concerned at the moment that actually some of the positive things that were done in response to the crisis are being rolled back now.
And just on that, the domestic violence in terms of the pandemic that you mentioned, maybe you just expand a bit on that, because some of the figures were quite shocking, I think, on that, the scale of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, like right at the beginning, you know, many of the frontline services were actually saying that there was a reduction in calls because women weren't able to even get out to make that call. And then all of the organisations worked together, all of the frontline services and with the government in the Still We're Here campaign, which then showed, I mean, increases of, you know, 20-25% on some helplines. And the experiences of women, you know, just trying to access services was being heard all over the phone lines and just how difficult it was. So I think it shows, you know, how prevalent domestic violence is in Ireland, and also how very underfunded. And I mean, I think that was the issue coming into the pandemic. You already had really underfunded frontline services who had waiting lists. And then you have this, you know, whole increase then in terms of the need for support. And it's one of the things I think we, you know, that's why I said that piece about we need to see this whole area, and particularly of domestic violence, within our core public services in terms of the supports that are needed.
So if I might come to you then, Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of Children's Rights Alliance, in terms then of children and where we're at in Ireland. Obviously, you know, we've seen the levels of deprivation have risen again from last year. Yeah. Showed through in the CSO. We obviously have issues around homelessness ongoing, and then COVID on top of that. What's your kind of analysis of where things are at now and how have children fared or are faring?
Yeah. I mean, it's hugely disappointing to see the deprivation rates increase from 2018 to 2019 for children and families, particularly because the government actually has been doing a lot to try and address child poverty. But I think one of the things that you can't really break the link with, if you think about why did that happen, why did deprivation increase from 2018 to 2019? That happens to coincide with the, I think, a spike in rents. As we have been saying to government, okay, we need to be investing in child poverty measures. But at the same time, if you do not fix our dysfunctional housing system, and if you expect families to pay rents, I mean, some of the families we've talked to about what they've been living through, one family talked to me about they were living in a one-bedroom apartment, there are four of them, and they were paying €1,800 a month to live in overcrowded circumstances. And that's the experience of children and families in Ireland pre-COVID. So we have to resolve the issue with the cost of rent and invest in a public national public housing program if we're going to address child poverty. Very similar to Orla, essentially what we're seeing now after COVID is that children that were disadvantaged and marginalised before the lockdown are far more disadvantaged after the lockdown. And if you think of why that is, you had a 6 months of children not being in school. And we know when children who are disadvantaged and marginalised and, you know, really struggle sometimes in school and need a lot of support to stay there, we know even in the summer months when they're not there, it has a big effect on them. There's a big, they call it learning loss in the summer months. And it's often why you see investment in programmes over the summer months. And some of the indicators we were getting, like we were brought together our members really quickly when the lockdown happened, said, okay, what do we need to do for children? And immediately all the education groups are saying already schools are really concerned about disadvantaged children. They think they are starting to disengage. Partly that was true to not really having your friends, the peer support that you get. But also a lot of them were struggling. They didn't have computers. You have families sharing phones, trying to communicate with the teacher. It was putting a lot of pressure on families. And Dipna Devine is doing a major study at the moment called School Life. And she quickly adapted to address COVID and what the teachers were saying. She was talking to about 29% of principals were reporting that had children that were disengaged in education. I mean, that's nearly one in three children disengaged from education during that COVID period. And what I'm really concerned about is you could have a generation of children who really drop out of school. They never succeed in the same way. We know what the trajectory is for you if this happens. If you don't leave school with qualifications and if you lose school early, you're going to find it really hard to hold on to a job. If you get a job, it's going to be low pay. You're going to really struggle to get decent housing. Your health is going to be compromised and you're going to have a shorter life. And you're basically are locked into a cycle of persistent poverty. So that this is a real threat for us. We've never experienced this in Ireland before, this interruption in children's education. The other thing that really came through during the lockdown as well was hunger and food poverty. And food poverty really affects children. You know, when a small child doesn't have enough to eat, you know, they don't feel loved. They're very unhappy. They're very irritable. And it starts really impacting their growth and their development. I mean, you can't go to school on an empty stomach. It's very hard to study or to learn or to engage with your pals in school if you haven't been fed properly. And what was really coming through from all our member organisations and coming through, like Orla talked about the domestic violence organisations, we were at a meeting with the domestic violence organisations. And the key thing they were talking about was food poverty, that families were really struggling to get food on the table, that suddenly this big loss in income, loss of jobs, and finding it really difficult to feed kids. Because basically what happens when people are experiencing this, if you are living this very stressful situation, you don't have enough money to pay the bills, pay the rent, feed your children, what families often do is they cut on the food bill to pay the rent. That's often what happens. And what they'll end up doing is feeding their children food that's really not good for them because it's cheaper. During the crisis, the Department of Education tried to address it by keeping the school meals program going throughout the lockdown. So primary schools and secondary schools that would have been getting free meals were able to continue on that basis. We were really concerned, though, about children in early years because there wasn't a similar program running. And we ran something ourselves with the help of some of the funders, and some of the stories coming through from parents, like, we were really shocked because we expected to hear from families that were already, you know, disadvantaged, going to in early year centres where they were getting a lot of support, and actually there were lots of new families that were experiencing poverty for the first time. And there was one woman in particular that told us that she essentially wasn't on the COVID payments, but she was out of work, and eventually came to the point where she had run out of money and she had nothing left. And she said that she was really, like, ashamed about the situation she had found herself in. And the local group that we funded said, look, we're going to put out parcels for families. And she said, you know, she fell down on her knees when she got the meat, when she got the potatoes, when she got the vegetables. And we heard that story again and again throughout the lockdown. So there's something there we need to address as a country when it comes to food poverty and hunger. It's not acceptable that families in this day and age within the country we have are experiencing hunger and food poverty at that rate. The other thing, though, that came through as well is the impact on children with disabilities. So we know, for example, we were getting a lot of reports from families who were doing 24-hour care with their children. And previously, their children might have been in daycare during the day. And there was no extra support for these families in this 24-hour day care loop. And they were at breaking points. So there was real concern about the welfare of these children and about the mental health of these parents trying to cope in this situation. But I mean, I talked about learning loss for disadvantaged children. But when it comes to children with disabilities, you know, losing 6 months of your program, there's no way for them to catch up. And the parents were well aware of this, the impact that it was having on children. And I have to say, you know, I really did feel throughout the lockdown, particularly in the early stages, we seemed to be more concerned about pubs, getting pubs open, than we were about getting schools open. And it took some time, I think, for the country to get to realise, actually, this is having an enormous effect on the population.
And why do you think that, you know, and maybe Orla and Tanya, you could both comment, it just seemed bizarre, that conversation about the pubs. I mean, I understand pubs, you know, are very important for social interaction and it's an important conversation, but to have it dominating in a way over and above, like, questions like, you know, the, as you talk about there, like real issues of you know, child poverty, and even I think around childcare as well, you know, and I think they never sorted the childcare out for the frontline workers. And why does society still, you know, deprioritize issues like this still?
Well, I think, you know, there's a few things in that. You know, I mean, there's the age-old piece of women and children, I would say, being deprioritized when it comes to, you know, when decisions have to be made about, you know, how you distribute resources. But I also think there's a very, very powerful lobbying you know, lobbying power from both retail and public and sector. And they're, it's not so much that their power is greater, I think, than organisations maybe in civil society, but I think they're heard a lot more by our political representatives. They're a lot closer to them, I think. And I mean, I'm not saying that scientifically, but that's certainly what I think, and that's my experience when these issues come up. And you know, we've seen a lot of that lobbying even in terms of previous pieces of legislation around alcohol as well in the country. You know, there's an enormous powerful lobbying group there. So I think that's part of it, as well as I think, you know, issues concerning women, because we saw it even in, you know, very straightforward ways how women weren't even considered in terms of the wage subsidy scheme. They were, you know, yeah, absolutely forgotten about when it came to women returning from pregnancy. And in fact, you know, they were being discriminated against, and legally, I mean, and the government had to do something about it. So they hadn't even thought about it. And that was actually the response we got in terms of some of those conversations. Do you know, we actually, you know, we never thought about it.
Yeah. And I think kind of what was maybe happening at the beginning of the lockdown as well is there was a very small group of decision makers, which was probably very necessary to actually deal with the immediate threat, because, you know, hundreds and thousands of people were about to die. Then that was the prospect if COVID-19 was able to progress on its journey, and they did, you know, an amazing job trying to keep us safe in those early months. But the downside of that approach was they didn't necessarily have the right people around the table that maybe had women's interests and children's interests. So the second roadmap comes out in May, and my phone starts hopping from the members going, what the hell? There's hardly anything about children in this. And there's talk about golf courses and about openings for golf courses. And I was like, it was clearly a reflection of some of the people that were around that table that had no reach into children and young people's lives. So, I mean, at that time we came out, we felt you're getting this wrong. You don't have the right people around the table. But the other thing I think as well around that period, you know, other countries were getting their schools open. They were getting their early years centres open. The data was coming in that actually it's not small children that spread the virus. We need to start getting them open. And I think we as a people, I think there was a major issue there about trying to reopen the schools. And I think we could have done better. You know, we should have gotten children back into school in June. We wouldn't have compromised people's health. And I think there's questions about that. Why, when it comes to something so fundamental for children, I mean, you have an absolute right to access education under the Constitution. Why did it take us so long to get our schools open and running again? Because when they did open, it was really successful. I mean, really, the opening of schools was really successful once it happened. There were a few issues there, but by and large, it has worked successfully.
And in terms of that, though, again, I push this again, because I still, to me, it seems like there's still a structural, you know, we have cultural, societal, structural problems here, that whether it's the legacies of, you know, the church, the, you know, patriarchal society, you know, that children are not prioritized, and obviously women as well, that it's just, it's not there, that we can sit back and leave this. And I just, it seems shocking to me still that we have this, you know, the deprivation figures are going up again, that, you know, all the conversations we've had, you know, what do we need to do to, and perhaps Louise, you could come in around this, that, you know, in terms of Irish society, why do we still not prioritise, and particularly the needs of the most disadvantaged children, but women and children, why in COVID, and why, you know, in terms of services?
It was actually really quite shocking. It's exactly as Orla said, that COVID did shine a light on inequalities that were there already. So it's an important thing. But one of the things that struck us, and people think it's quite trivial, but it was actually quite a harsh reality, was when COVID first started and supermarkets started tightening up regulations, and there were signs up outside saying children weren't allowed in. There was absolutely no accommodation made for lone parents with children. And when we tried to highlight it at the very start, and when we tried to say it is not possible for us to abandon our children to go and get essential shopping, we were told certain things like, well, why don't you leave the children with neighbours? The schools are closed because we're not supposed to be meeting. Leave them in a car. Again, the dangers of leaving a child in a car, but also the assumption that every lone parent had a car. Have you not got grandparents? Yes, we have grandparents, some of us, but unfortunately, we're not going to risk our children infecting it. And all of these negative things. And then was, well, just try to sort out your shopping yourself. Now, there was accommodations made, and rightly so, for people cocooning and vulnerable people cocooning, and a special hours for them to access supermarkets. But that sense of being locked out, and there were women who cried on the phone to me, literally crying on the phone to me, saying the post offices were sometimes located into supermarkets, and they weren't allowed into the supermarket to access the post office to collect their social welfare payment, and standing outside shops crying, not even able to access the social welfare. And that sense of exclusion, and it made us realize, like, people can be quite liberal and we're open to certain things in society a lot more than we were, which is all brilliant. But when it came down to the nitty-gritty, lone parents were left standing outside supermarkets, not even able to access the social welfare payment. And when we tried to raise it, we were told we were being pathetic. Find another way to do your shopping. And that sense of exclusion really hit to bone. And a lot of people felt a sense of shame. I spoke to one woman and she said that she has experienced severe domestic abuse. She has experienced loads of different horrific things in her life, but being turned away from a major supermarket in front of her colleagues because she had children. She said she never felt so much shame. And she went to bed that night crying in bed. And she said she cried so much that she said the eyelashes in her eyes got stuck inside her. And every time she opened and closed her eyes, this is a strong woman who's encountered loads of hostility before. But this particular thing, where all of society seemed to be closing the door and forgetting about our children and our needs, was really, really hurtful. And why? I don't know. That sense of shame is still there, Rory.
Yeah, that sense of shame and, of course, stigma, and what that does to people then, of course, is they feel even less inclined to actually speak up for themselves and speak up on issues. Tanya, sorry, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really struck me at the beginning of the lockdown was, you might remember, the one area where they got the messaging wrong was around talking about children, that they talked about children being vectors of infection. And that, unfortunately, stuck. So then you got these situations where supermarkets decided not to let women and children in to do their shopping. And we were hearing from members that, you know, children and families were walking in the streets and being tutted at as they were walking by, and actually starting to feel, God, should I be out at all? You know, there was a lot of that going on at the time. And then young people then were being demonized. I mean, they continue to be demonized. And I just don't think that's the right approach. But it had a direct effect on families' ability to just do the very basic things, like go and do basic shopping. And it took the Department of the Taoiseach having to actually speak at the podium and say, you need to let people into supermarkets to try and stop that. So, I mean, there's something there we need to be really careful about when we do talk about children in the media and in public, because it can have direct consequences for how children are treated.
Yeah.
And Tanya, while you're saying that, Tanya, that is very true. But even after the Taoiseach got up, and that was after intervention from all groups like National Women's Council and Children's Rights Alliance, after we all joined together, even after that, that case I spoke to was about 2 weeks after. So that didn't even have a major impact. And what you're saying there, like, I'm talking about the shame that woman felt of society's rejection. Her children, like, what would her children have felt? And what did all the children, whether they be in one parent or two parent families, feel with that description of being called vectors? They were being treated like monsters, as if they were the cause of all of this. It was a terrible, nasty narrative that older people were to be cocooned and children were to be avoided like the plague, that they were the plague carriers. And I think we need to examine why we took that, quickly adopted that nasty narrative.
Yeah, no, and I think it feeds into or taps into some deep, you know, societal cultural problems that we really have to address around stigmatization of lone parents and still an attitude of not prioritizing children. Just Louise, maybe you could outline, because the CSO statistics showed in terms of 2019, of course, this is pre-COVID, that lone parents still one of the highest rates of poverty and deprivation and had increased. Again, could you explain, maybe?
Well, it's not even that it's one of the highest rates. The deprivation rates among lone parent families is 45%. 0.4%, as opposed to 17% in the general population. Like, why do we say we are, you know, so it's almost three times higher. So we're saying we're an inclusive society, and yet, and that we treat all people equally, and yet we accept that because a child is born in a lone parent family, they're more likely, almost three times more likely to live and experience deprivation. There's something wrong in our psyche that we accept that as acceptable. Well, they're always poor, so it's not much different than previous years. There's something fundamentally wrong in a wealthy society as our own. COVID obviously will make things more difficult for lone parents. We already know the problem around childcare. Schools are you know, schools are back up and running, but as we know, schools are up and running, but if your child gets a cough, they're out for a week. You know, parents have to be basically full-time on call for the schools. That's the only way the schools are operating. In a two-parent family, that is extremely difficult. In a lone parent family, it is impossible. And it's very hard for lone parents to get back into work in a precarious work situation anyway. Now, one of my big fears is, and it has been from the start, is this whole childcare and school issue is really going to have a negative impact on lone parents who have managed to kind of get jobs around school hours and break the mold and really, against all odds, fight to get their jobs. That currently, like, there are a lot of restaurants, pubs, small retailers, all different jobs going to be affected by COVID, and they're looking to downsize their job market. You know, the easiest people to get rid of without paying redundancy would be just to make hours awkward for lone parents. They can't do it and they're forced to resign. And even to qualify for a pandemic unemployment payment, they may have to give up their job to get that if their jobs remain open. So there's all these additional things that we think lone parents particularly will be pushed out of the job market because we don't have the flexibility that a two parent has. And like, please, I understand it's hard for two parent families too. But as a one parent, to try to manage every time the school. One parent told us that in their school in Ballyfermot, they were told that if your child is suspected of having COVID and put in the isolation room, you will have an hour to go and collect your child. And if you don't collect your child in that hour, they will charge you €130 because they will get a taxi firm to bring your child home, but then to disinfect the taxi and to pay for the taxi being off the road while it's being disinfected. It'll be €130. So there's that fear of parents going into work thinking, if I can't get back to my child if something happens, I could be fined €130 by the school. So many are just saying, is it worth keeping on my job? Can I keep up my job and be there for what the school is looking for?
Yeah, I think that is such an important issue, particularly as we're coming into the budget, because, you know, I mean, the figures from revenue there, was it last week, you know, really did show that it's workers, and, you know, they're made up of lone parents, they're also made up of migrant workers, the workers on the edge who are in those precarious low paid jobs, you know, barely in. They're the jobs that have been lost. And I mean, it's the higher paid jobs that have, you know, managed to stay in terms of people working from home. But it's, I mean, you're so right, because it's the combination of not having the proper childcare, also not really having, not, I mean, I know for so many parents not having any after school, that when you put all of those things together, well, what, you know, why wouldn't you just pull out? And I think that is so difficult. It's so difficult in terms of how we're going to tackle poverty, but also in terms of any long-term sort of thinking around lone parents and around all of workers who are in those precarious positions. I mean, I think certainly from the Women's Council, this is a key piece that the budget has to really look at, is how do you support people to be able to stay in the labour force. And certainly what we're seeing at the minute in terms of, you know, the changes to all the pandemic payments, the reductions, we're starting to go in the opposite direction, and we will leave lone parents behind. And I mean, I think that's a real concern.
I think as well, Orla, there's a real concern we're leaving lone parents behind, and that's a short-term problem. But from a women's point of view and a women's equality point of view, it's a long-term problem. Mm. Because if a woman is out of work for 10 or 15 years because of the care issues, it's very difficult. She goes back in her mid-40s, late-40s, to a low-paid job. She's no pension rights, and that's a long-term poverty trajectory she's on because of she's sacrificed 10 or 15 years of her life because of lack of care. And that's the worry, because we're seeing it in Spark now. A lot of the women who would have started in Spark maybe 10 years ago and couldn't manage because of childcare, because maybe being in rural locations, which made it even more difficult, who've been out of the labour market and now trying to get back into it. You know, how do you do that at 10 euro when you're 45 years old? Very difficult.
Yeah. I mean, and the interesting thing from a child poverty point of view is if you look at the data and all the research and the evidence, it tells us that the best investment to address child poverty is to invest in the education, training, providing good quality work opportunities for women, and quality childcare that's free and accessible alongside it. That's actually the key if you want to address child poverty. There's lots of things you can do, but if you don't get that right, and I don't think we're getting that right in this country. I mean, you know, are we, when we invest in employment programs for known parents, are they any good? What's the quality of them? Are we planning actually childcare facilities alongside the employment program so she can actually go and take up the program and ensure that she doesn't actually have to pay childcare costs alongside it, or that there's someone there that can look after our child as well? I mean, the other thing that really strikes me, and this is the work that really Spark has really led out on, is, you know, the government did introduce a national childcare scheme. There's lots of advantages, and including, you know, if your income is below, your take-home income is below 26,000 euros, so that, you know, that captures everyone on the industrial wage. You can get up to 170 euros a week to subsidise your childcare. The only problem with that is, we have a market-based system. The price of childcare, it ranges vastly from, you know, an average 320 a week in Dunleary to 170 a week in Leitrim. So we're expecting people and women on low incomes to actually use their other income, which is really, really should be just focused towards feeding their families or subsidising their rent and household. We're expecting them to eat into that income so they can engage in childcare. So we're not giving families real options to actually avail of good work, avail of good training and education opportunities. And if we crack that nut, you would see a big change in those child poverty statistics. I absolutely guarantee you. It's happened in other countries. That's how they solve their problem. We have to solve it here.
So what, Tanya, do you think then in terms of moving on to that, what should be specifically in the budget around that?
Well, I think we have to bite the bullet and agree to make childcare free for low-income families. And if there is a payment, it's nothing more than about 5 euros a week or something like that. That's what we have to do, right? We know that. All the evidence and data is screaming that tells us we have to do that. There are very simple solutions in relation that we could employ. That's the first thing I'd do if I was Roderick O'Gorman, the Minister for Children, etc. The other thing that we need to start doing is we need to look, map out what's available in terms of education and training opportunities out there for lone parents. And we need to look at, are we actually providing childcare alongside those programs as well? We also need to look at low pay. I mean, we need to make sure that the minimum wage does increase. That has a direct effect on low income families. And other things such as rent is the other key as well. We need to look at rent supplementation levels. I think if you had several of those measures coming together, I think you'd help safeguard this very marginalised group of families that have been living now persistently in poverty for several years of their lives. I mean, it has a devastating effect on children when they are living like this from day to day, week to week. Same impact on parents as well. You know, it's a very stressful life every day trying to work out, how am I going to feed the family? How am I going to pay the rent this week? I mean, children see it very early on. They see the stress that their parents are under, and they learn not to ask their parents for anything. So the birthday party that comes up, they know they need a fiver for a present. They don't tell the parents that there's a birthday party coming up. They don't want to let them know. Well, they don't have new runners for the beginning of the school year, they pretend they're okay with that. That's something that children tell us that they do, that they really pretend everything is okay to their parents because they're trying to support their parents as much as they can. And that's just not good enough. It has a terrible effect on children because it starts lowering their horizons about what's possible for their lives. They start thinking that they don't, all the things that other kids are getting to do, they think that's not really on the horizon for them. And it really changes how they think about themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that whole area is the impact on children of, you know, inequality and poverty and the long-term impacts. And interesting, I've had some interesting conversations around the physiological health impacts on children of that, what's called toxic stress from, you know, inequality and poverty is very significant. Just the Orla then, and then Louise, what Orla first, what are your kind of key proposals for what you think should be in the government's budget in a couple of weeks' time?
Yeah, well, our pre-budget submission, I mean, we're calling it, you know, a sort of a plan for a feminist recovery. And it's based on, I suppose, 3 to 4 sort of key elements. One is about universal public services. So that includes housing, it includes childcare, and also thinking of things as, so for example, what I was saying around supports for domestic violence services, seeing them as public services and putting them into that frame. So there's the whole public services bit. And then the next part is about how do you maintain people's attachment to work? So there's, you know, we have a series of recommendations around the welfare system and also about employment. And then the third piece is about equality budgeting and saying that the decisions that are made in this budget need to be looked at on a lens of both women's equality and broader equality, because that's missing and it's been missing in COVID. And then the fourth bit is also about how you raise revenue. And that's about a progressive model of taxation, which is talking about things like wealth tax. Like, why the hell are we giving so much tax relief on private pensions? We could be reducing that, which could fund a universal pension. So it's about a more progressive model of taxation. So that's what our pre-budget submission is based around. And particularly then it goes into things like a public childcare model. So, you know, Tanya sort of mentioning the initial stages of that. And that that really needs to be, I suppose, grasped in this budget and a commitment made to it and then to start to do it. And similarly, in terms of, you know, both increases in terms of the houses that we're building, in terms of public houses, but also in terms of much greater movement on that cost rental model that you've written about, Rory. And I think the housing bit is going to be key in this budget. And because, like, if we can tackle, you know, if people aren't paying exorbitant rents and they aren't paying this massive money for childcare, that will lead to a much better quality of life for all families, for women and for everyone in society. So they're the types of issues that we're hitting at in this budget.
Very good. Thanks. And Louise, in terms of
we're not going to argue with any of those, put it that way. But the universal childcare is obviously key for lone parents. And Tanya's right, the National Childcare Scheme has really badly let down lone parents, especially when it gets to school-aged children. And that's when lone parents would generally try to start working. And the maximum subsidy at the moment is €63 a week for a school-aged child. That doesn't cover school age, you know, aftercare. And it basically locks out parents who may not be earning enough to go back to work, but want to go back into training. So if they can't afford to go into training, you're forcing them into low paid long-term work. And that's something that we really need. So we'd very much be looking at for the National Childcare Scheme to be re-evaluated and to prioritise lone parents and people who really need the childcare. And also to have an aspect of the, you know, a lot of the early care child providers are saying that the new childcare scheme is very much based on labour activation and not on the needs of children. So they've been forced this year, this September, to turn away school-aged children based on the parents' relationship with the job market, not on whether the child needs that care. And for some, it's an early intervention. It's a way of keeping an eye on the child. It's making sure the child gets a dinner after school. And the fact that we're turning them around because of the child's the parents' relationship with the labour market is actually quite scary, and it's not child-centred. So we'd be really pushing on that. Obviously, the housing is a huge issue for us. I mean, almost 60% of the homeless families in Dublin and Ireland are housed in lone parent households. That's scary. That's worrying. We need to find out why. One of the things that we have asked as well would be that mortgage interest supplement be restored. There's a lot of women in abusive relationships are stuck in those abusive relationships purely because there is the fear that they will end up in homelessness. And one of the things is the mortgage interest supplement ended in 2014, in budget that by Joan Burton as well. And that loss of mortgage interest supplement has been a huge detriment to people. So if the father, if you get your barring order, say, and if the father moves out and doesn't want to pay the mortgage, a woman is left at home and gets no support. If she's in rented accommodation, she can access HAP payment, she can access rent supplement. If she's in a mortgaged property, she gets no help towards her housing needs. So she could be getting, if for a lone parent with two children, you'd be getting €270 a week. Try paying a mortgage and feeding your children on €270 a week. We've asked that mortgage interest supplement would be restored. The cost, if that isn't restored and that family ends up in homeless accommodation, emergency accommodation costs €32,000 a year to hold that family. Why not give them €600 a month to keep them in the home and avoid that stress? So that would be a huge thing to ask for us as well. It's what we're seeing on the ground that is causing lone parent families to exit and into homelessness. And then the other thing that we have asked for years and we will continue to ask is the statutory type of maintenance collection. It is key that children are supported by the partner and the state endorses that. At the moment, if I don't pay my property tax, Rory, the revenue will go directly to my employers and make sure it's deducted. Mm-hmm. If a man or a woman doesn't pay for their child, the other parent is gone through the court system trying to get it. And it's a useless system and it doesn't work. And women and children are being failed and forced into poverty. So they would be some of the key asks. So childcare, housing and maintenance. We've known, all the reports have told us, these are the protections lone parents need. And obviously the other thing would be good quality work. And so then I'd endorse Tania and Orla's call for universal services and, you know, proper well-paid jobs with well-trained people.
Just that's really, really useful and I think interesting and really important to highlight, you know, the issues that you've highlighted. And in many ways, it's like an agenda for a progressive republic of equality that, you know, if we got these measures moved. And I think there was definitely over the last couple of years that we've seen a trajectory change in attitudes of the Irish public, increasingly being in favour of investment in public services rather than tax cuts. And a kind of shift, very clear shift back against kind of neoliberal policies. What do you feel now where we're at in terms of that? Are we, has COVID kind of regressed a certain amount of people back to just looking after themselves? Or do we think that there's that sense of solidarity is still there? Or as a society, where do you think within COVID we're going kind of politically, culturally, do you think?
Well, we had this, we're all in it together, and that was a great mantra at the start, and it was great to see things like community call come in place, and there was this kind of protection. But now when you see the pandemic unemployment payment being cut, you wonder how much are we in it together? I mean, as I think it was Tanya said about, there are some workers, or maybe earlier, that workers who are able to work from home have not been affected. They've probably financially benefited from COVID. And then workers who can't, through no fault of their own, can't access work, are being penalised. I mean, one of the simplest things would be to, if we were really shown cohesion and social solidarity, would be to ensure that the pandemic payment was maintained for families.
Yeah. I agree on what you're saying around, like, I think as often in our society, there's a big difference between where the public is at and where political leadership is at. Yeah. So, like, I think, I mean, from the stuff that we would have done, the Women's Council over the last few months, and I mean, actually last week there was part of a campaign, we're part of the 4-day week campaign, that we, you know, there was opinion polls released, research released in terms of people's attitudes to it. And there was overwhelmingly from the public support for that. So I think some things have shifted over COVID in terms of what people value as important. And that's why I think, you know, there is a new discussion on care, for example, now, and also how we work and how we link work as well to issues around care and work-life balance. So in some ways, I think for the public, there is different conversations happening, but certainly when we see what's happening around like our political leadership at the moment, where we're talking about, you know, rolling back on payments when people have not walked back into their jobs, I mean, it seems very separate and you know, absolutely not linked to the reality of people's lives right now. So I think there is that bigger divide. And also I think, you know, for a lot of people, I mean, this budget, you know, there was a really important election where people voted for change. And I know that's in some ways long forgotten because of COVID, but it certainly doesn't look like to me that we're going to see any of that change delivered in terms of things like public service, like public services. And I think we are into a period where COVID will, to some extent, what be used as an excuse for not doing some of the things that need to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. I think on top of all that, the social solidarity that people expressed earlier in the year was amazing to see. It was amazing to see how communities came together and stood together to help more vulnerable people within their communities. And I think we probably haven't sustained that sufficiently, I think, over the summer months. And I think people are starting to feel insecure. I think the effects of, you know, not seeing people, having family members who've gotten COVID, the low pay, all of that is starting to catch up, I think, with people at the moment. And I suppose one of the things that we haven't even talked about or got to grip with is the situation in London and in the UK. You know, there are two very serious things looming over the Irish people, and you know, again, creating more uncertainty for us. But a hard Brexit is back on the table, unfortunately. That's going to hit low-income workers. We have the threat of violence around the border if that proceeds. And the other thing that's really worrying is that Boris Johnson's government is threatening to pull out of aspects of the European Convention on Human Rights. And that's the golden thread holding together the Good Friday Agreement. So we are looking at a situation, if you talk to human rights campaigners in the north, they are saying this is the end of the peace process as we know it if this proceeds. So alongside all of this, we have the fact that the country is borrowing massive amounts of money to hold up certain industries. We're not necessarily getting the reform that we need, that Orla and Louise are talking about in terms of public services. So we're going to need really strong leadership to get us through the next 18 months. And we're going to have to hear what people want. We're going to have to listen to what children and young people want. And we're going to have to make tough decisions as well in that period. I mean, it's a pity communications, I think, government-wise, they haven't been strong in the last quarter. And I think they have to get to grip with that, because people are starting to feel the pinch, they're starting to feel the uncertainty, and that's really starting to encroach on the national psyche.
Well, Tania, Orla, Louise, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic. It was great to have you.
Thanks, Rory.
Thanks, Rory.
Thanks, Rory.
No worries. I think that it's really interesting, the conversation, and hopefully it will, you know, give people some thought around kind of the issues that you're bringing up. And I think that there is, you know, some, try to take some positives out of it. I think that there is increased awareness, particularly around the need for quality public services, as you talk about as well, that care, the need to focus on care and the importance of that. And I do still feel that mood for change and desire for change amongst people is still there, but the question is, how is it progressed now? And I think all of your advocacy and work is really, really important, so thank you for doing that. So as always, listeners, please support us on tortoiseshack.ie, become a patron. We need the support to keep these podcasts being produced, and we will see you all soon. Thank you.